Time now for Minnesota Reads here on 103.3 KUMD. And it's taken forever, but I'm so glad we got Dr. John Pastor to come in and join us. He has written a book called What Should a Clever Moose Eat? Natural History, Ecology, and the North Woods. And you even, I just realized, you illustrated it too?
Yeah. Yep. Are the cover painting is mine and all the drawings are mine.
Are you a Renaissance man?
No.
I don't believe it for a minute. It's how wonderful it is when you have known somebody for a while and you discover that your friends have secret talents that you never suspected.
Oh, I never made a secret of it. Well, I just don't broadcast it over KUMD every week.
What's the matter with you, John? We're going to have you be the guest host for all of our arts programming from now on, that you're an artist. So, yeah, well, the word's out, John. Sorry about that. So I've been hearing about this book, and as a matter of fact, yesterday I was just telling you we had done an interview with Nate Polash of Cafe Scientifique, mm-hmm. and he said that you were going to be the featured speaker for the July program, and I thought, I've been meaning to talk to John about this book.
Yeah. Incidentally, Nate got his master's degree here in mathematics, and he took some of my classes, and I was on his committee. And then he went to Tennessee and got a PhD there. With some people I know there, and now he's back here. So I'm really happy that he's back here. He was a great student.
And he is so excited about science. How come he got a master's in math if he's a science?
Well, his thesis was kind of mathematics of ecosystems. And I worked with Harlan Stetch and Bruce Peckham in the math department on these problems. So it's kind of writing equations for biological processes that happen in nature. So it's kind of on the edge between mathematics and biology.
Fascinating academia. I mean, the things that go together that you never thought would go together. So, John Pastor, artist and author, what should a clever moose eat?
That is an interesting question that we have spent. I started thinking about that when I first got here 32 years ago, and we've been working on that and thinking about it for 32 years. And I think we know some of the answer, but we don't know all of it. The problem with the moose is that most of the food that's out there is not very good food. It's difficult to digest. And in the winter, think about it, a moose just gets to eat twigs. So it's subsisting on a diet of something that's not much more nutritious than a pencil. But it needs about 10 or 15 pounds or more of food a day, minimum. And it's got to make it through cold weather and snow. And if you're a cow, you're pregnant, and so you have to be feeding your fetus. And so how should a moose eat? What should it do? And that's, if you want to know more of the answer, that's what the problem is. But if you want to know the answer, you have to read the book. So it's a plug for the book.
Oh, John. We're non-commercial. We can't do that. I'm sorry. You'll have to spill all of the secrets of the book right here, right now. 32 years ago, when you started asking these questions, was there the same concern about the dwindling moose population that there is now?
No, the moose population was quite healthy back then.
So are you going to tell me I have? Well, of course you'll tell me I have to read the book. What's changed in between then and now?
A lot of things have changed. Ron Moen, who is my former graduate student who did his thesis on moose with me, is now kind of the lead on doing the research on that. He's a professor now in the biology department at UMD. He's seen come up with a number of causes. One is possibly wolf predation, the other possibly diseases. There doesn't seem to be any clear one thing. My suspicion is when there's not one clear thing that stands out, you have to look at the habitat. Because generally speaking, if the habitat is in good shape, then most wildlife populations can bounce back from really high mortality, even 40% mortality. In the 1990s, there was a winter tick infestation of moose, and 40% of the moose died in one winter. And within 3 years, they were back up to the population that was before. So I think there have been a number of things that have changed in the habitat. Our cutting practices are different. fire has come through, some of which create habitat for moose and some of which doesn't create habitat for moose. And I think that a combination of a lot of things, but my suspicion is that changes in habitat over the last 30 years or so are the underlying cause of a lot of other things that then sort of come in and make things worse.
Now, it's certainly isn't going to be as easy to create habitat for moose as it is to plant milkweed for monarchs,
right,
for example.
Right.
But are there things that people could do who really live out in the tulies that would like to see moose?
Well, what moose need is younger tracts of land that have been recently cleared or burned. So there's a lot of regeneration of aspen and willow and the preferred food for moose, birch. But they also need conifers for cover. So they need this odd mix of old conifers that they could get under and shelter from the heat and from the snow and even find refuge from moose adjacent to young 5-year-old aspen stands. Because of our history of cutting, a good bit of our landscape right now is 30 to 40 year old aspen, which is probably the least useful habitat for moose. And so I think if we wait a while, that aspen is going to start to break up and fires will come through and regenerate the younger stands that the moose need for food. But also, some of the aspen might just die, and there's a lot of spruce and fir growing up underneath it. You see this when you're driving down the road all the time. And when the birch is dying, it's going to be replaced by spruce and fir. So I think if the moose population can hold out another decade or so, the habitat is automatically going to recover. In the meantime, look at your property. If you don't have conifers on your property, start planting some spruce, particularly. You could get that from the St. Louis County, South St. Louis County Soil and Water Conservation District. They have their seedling sales every spring.
And I'm smiling because I'm saying they're just bite-sized for moose.
The moose won't eat spruce. So
okay.
You can plant the spruce and the moose will leave them alone.
Okay.
If your stands are old, maybe consider, if you have enough land, doing a small timber sale and regenerating some aspen sucker sprouts so the moose can eat it. But that's what you want to strive for. You want to strive for a combination of old conifer and younger aspen. A good mix of that in the same vicinity.
I'm asking you a question that I have no idea if you know the answer to, and I don't want you to feel bad about it, but I'm really curious about it. There are so many of these diseases and illnesses that can be vaccinated for in domestic livestock.
Right.
And I realize that moose are not like cattle and moose are not like horses, but are there any of these diseases or even tick infestations that it would be possible to somehow either inoculate for or, I mean, if you're going to put a collar on a moose, could you put a tick collar on a moose?
Well, you could put a collar on a moose, but it's taken, right now Ron has about 100 collars on moose and we have 8,000 moose in the state or there. No, it's less than that. It used to be 8,000. It's what, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 now. So it took a lot of work to get those 100
right.
collars on moose and helicopter support and everything else. It's virtually impossible
okay.
to vaccinate a wildlife population. What we have to do is, and this is part of what we don't understand yet about the ecology in North Woods, what is tick habitat? What are ticks, what habitat do ticks need? We really don't know that. I mean, you walk through the woods, it's generally kind of brushy habitat and stuff, but we really don't know very much about the ecology of ticks. And so if we want to protect moose from ticks, we need to study the basic biology of ticks. And that's an interesting part of the research I do. People see particular environmental problems, and they say, well, why don't you study that problem and fix it? And the problem is, and that's a good question, and these are important problems, and we need to fix it. But oftentimes, the way you need to address a particular problem like that is to kind of do an end run around and do a lot of basic research on things that you didn't think were originally connected with that problem. And then when people hear, you know, well, why are you doing research on that? Well, you know, trust us. There is a reason for it. But we know there's so much we don't know about how the organisms and species that comprise the North Woods, how they interact with each other. And so that makes it hard for foresters and land managers to actually predict what is going to be the consequence of what they do. They do the best they can with the knowledge they have. A lot of it is seat of the pants, on-the-ground knowledge of their particular ranger district. But we don't have a lot of the basic research to support the decisions they need to make.
So how to get a healthy moose population doesn't necessarily require going out and collaring all 3,000 moose. It requires what does a clever moose eat?
Right.
How do we provide the habitat? Right. Ticks are a problem. What kind of habitat do ticks like?
Right.
Can we do anything to minimize that?
Exactly.
What other things, you know, what about wolf populations? You mentioned wolf predation, populations.
Right.
So it's a lot of looking at how all the pieces fit together.
And with the collars, these are GPS collars that take locations. You could set it to take a location every 5 minutes, every 15 minutes or whatever, to find out how in detail does a moose move through the landscape and how does it use the landscape. What that ends up doing is generating a bucket load, many, many buckets. And when I say a bucket, I don't mean a 5 gallon bucket. I mean, you know, a bucket that you put on the end of a front end loader worth of data. And so now there are computational and mathematical problems of how do you analyze all that data to see what the patterns are in that data. And so we need to sometimes develop new mathematics to deal with all the data we're collecting. And
John, you've been working, and one last question. I could talk with you about this all morning, but you've been working on this book for a long time. You talked about a series of essays that you've written over the years. Did you, at some point toward the end of the process, kind of stick your head up and look around and say, this book is important because people need to understand the importance of science?
Yeah, they need to understand the importance of science, but they also need to get out in the woods and make observations themselves. Most of my research and the research of many of my colleagues start with a very simple observation that anybody can make walking around in the woods. If you just know enough to be able to ask those questions. And that doesn't mean you have to have a degree in biology, but you need to know just something about how nature works and to be able to identify, you know, some of the major tree species and flower species are out there. But we're not teaching our kids these things in school anymore. When I was in school, I learned these things. And I spent a lot of my summers in the woods with my grandfather and hunting and fishing with my uncles and just being in the woods myself. Kids aren't doing that anymore. And so it becomes hard.
Do you think
that
this contributes to people's skepticism of science in some instances?
Yes. They think science is some bizarre thing that people in white coats do and they can never understand. There's a lot about other sciences I don't understand. I barely understand anything about neurobiology, for example, or molecular biology. It's just not something I was trained in. But the basic questions that science asks and how we go about the basic approach of answering those questions, anybody can understand that with the intelligent layperson, as we used to say, can understand that with a high school education. And what's important is a little bit of curiosity, an open mind and open eyes when you're walking through the woods. And so anybody can do that. And one of the main reasons why I wrote this book was to introduce people to that way of thinking as they wander through the woods and hike through the woods in northern Minnesota or anywhere in the North Woods from here to New England and in canoe in the Boundary Waters. As you're doing this, just look around and say, why does that plant grow? Why do I see this plant growing or this tree growing only in this particular kind of situation? On the south sides of hills instead of the north sides of hills. I mean, that's a question that could lead to a PhD thesis. And you don't have to do the PhD thesis, but you have to be able to open your eyes and use your curiosity and be able to say to yourself, that's an interesting question. I'd like to know the answer to that.
And start asking your kids questions. And when they ask questions, the one thing that parents can do now that our folks couldn't do is they can look it up.
Right.
Not in the Boundary Waters, chances are, where you can't get, probably can't get a decent cell phone signal.
Yeah.
But they can say, hey, I don't know. Sit down here next to me and let's look it up.
Let's look it up. Your son or daughter or your grandchild picks up a rock and says, what kind of rock is this? You can look it up. And you could match it pretty well to what you could see on the web. And
so you're taking the question seriously.
Yeah.
You're teaching them how to find the answers to the questions.
Right. You're teaching them that this is a serious question, that you're encouraging them to ask this question. And eventually, maybe they don't become scientists, but they're not afraid of science.
No. And they know how to look things up. Maybe they're reporters.
Yeah, right.
John, thanks so much for joining us. It's always such a treat to have you in our studios. John Pastor, longtime friend of KUMD, and so glad to have him as our guest this morning to talk about his book, What Would a Clever Moose Eat? Here on Minnesota Reads. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Programming on KUMD is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, reminding you to designate a sober driver, call a cab, take public transportation, or crash on a friend's couch so you don't crash on the road. More information on how to protect yourself and others from impaired driving is online at drivesafermn.com.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An alliance of tribal leaders from the United States and chiefs of First Nations from Canada came together Tuesday in Rapid City, South Dakota, to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline and tar sands expansion. On the 4th of July, tribal leaders signed agreements to also oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline and to stop the Interior Department from removing Yellowstone grizzly bears from the endangered species list. A representative from Manitoba tells Victoria Wicks that 150 years of treaty violations have led to environmental destruction.
Kevin Hart is the Manitoba Regional Chief for the Assembly of First Nations. He says First People in Canada, as in the United States, entered into treaties with the federal government. He says those legal agreements were created to ensure the welfare of all so that all people could share resources and thrive. But now, he says, Indigenous people in both nations live in abject poverty.
Obviously, that's a direct breach of the treaty because, you know, we're living in third world conditions. And yet, corporations and federal governments reap from the benefits of the extraction of all the natural resources that we see occurring on the lands and the water.
Hart says even though treaties and constitutions require it, federal governments don't consult tribes before allowing land to be disturbed for pipelines, hydroelectric power, and mining. He says in Canada those developments have disrupted fishing and hunting industries in remote locations, resulting in elevated food prices and poor nutrition. And he notes that the United States is the leading customer for Canadian exports.
It says in our prophecies, you know, after the last tree's been cut down, after the last water has been polluted and such, after the last animal has been killed off, they said, you'll realize that you can't eat money.
Through efforts of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and other government-to-government accords, Hart says First Peoples' voices are heard more widely and their rights are recognized globally. But he says time is running out for protecting the planet. The alliance includes representatives of the Blackfoot Confederacy, the Great Sioux Nation, and the Ponca Nation. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Five members of the Canadian military are in hot water and have been relieved of their duties pending an investigation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the group disputed an Indigenous ceremony on Canada Day.
This is Mi'kmaq territory. This is not Canada.
This is Canada.
It might have been
Mi'kmaq.
So you don't have Canadian ID, you don't pay your taxes, you don't have a Medicare card?
This is not an argument.
Well, it is.
It wasn't exactly an altercation, it wasn't violent, but it was improper, according to Canada's most senior military officials, and especially for members of the Canadian military who serve their country. The group was dressed the same in black polo shirts with yellow piping, and they carried the Canadian Red Ensign flag, the country's national flag, until it was replaced by the Maple Leaf in 1965. They also said they were members of the Canadian chapter of the Proud Boys. That's a group that claims it will no longer apologize for creating the modern world and won't discriminate on the basis of race or sexuality. A Mi'kmaq woman, Rebecca Thomas, was at the ceremony and witnessed the event.
I was nervous. I was very nervous as to what could happen, right? If you have, young, brash men and passionate protesters coming together, that doesn't always have a happy ending.
In a statement from Ottawa, Canada's Chief of Defense Staff, Jonathan Vance, apologized to the Indigenous community, saying also that he detests any action by the Canadian forces that is intended to show disrespect towards the very people and cultures we value in Canada. And the Minister of Defense said there would be consequences for military personnel in or out of uniform who express intolerance. The Mi'kmaq ceremony took place in Halifax in front of the statue of Edward Cornwallis, who was the founder of the city and its first governor, but who was also responsible for declaring a controversial bounty on Mi'kmaq scalps in the mid-1700s. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Thank you.
Music from Bob Geldof this morning on 103.3 KUMD. Our programming on KUMD is made possible in part by Weiss Eye Center in Hermantown, offering Z-LASIK Advanced Laser Vision Correction. Z-LASIK is a blade-free, all-laser procedure allowing a one-day recovery period. More information for registration and for consultation is available at Weiss Eye Center by phone at 218-625-1917 or online at weisseyecenter.com. KUMD also supported in part by Grandma's Marathon featuring the Park Point 5-miler Thursday, July 13th. Registration is open and all finishers receive a shirt. All proceeds benefit the Young Athletes Foundation. More information at grandmasmarathon.com. Today's weather brought to you in part by the Ski Hut, celebrating 62 years of serving the Northland's bicycle, kayak, and stand-up paddleboard needs. This morning in the Northland, we've got that severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 11 o'clock. Showers and thunderstorms could possibly redevelop again this afternoon, and it's going to continue to be hot and muggy this morning. We'll have high temperatures today near 88 degrees. For tomorrow, then, mostly sunny and cooler with highs only near 73 degrees. Right now, beautiful downtown Duluth at 64, over the hill at 64, and it's 70 degrees this morning in Superior. KUMD programming supported in part by Duluth's Best Bread, baking country loaves by hand the old school way. Available at Duluth's Best Bread today from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And when they're gone, they're gone. 8:54, and this is Northland Morning.
Love's the best I've ever known, but that I will attest. Alison Crutchfield's musical career has been defined by collaboration, from P.S. Eliot with her twin sister Katie of Waxahachie to pop punk outfit Swearin', but this year she released her debut full-length solo album. We talk about going it alone after the breakup of a band and a relationship. Alison Crutchfield on the next World Cafe.
The World Cafe this afternoon at 3 o'clock on 103.3 KUMD.
Well, after a long week of work, you are weary, frantic, and hungry. You need to feed your soul. So tune in to Soul Village on KUMD. Every Friday, we cook up some fine funk, delectable R&B, and savory soul music. Tasty, tasty, tasty. Find the music to feed your need with a visit to Soul Village Friday afternoons at 5 right here on 103.3 KUMD, the Duluth Alternative.
103.3 KUMD. We'd like to thank our guests this morning, Dr. John Pastor and Andrea Shocker. And thanks to them so much for stopping by. You make the coffee and we'll make the radio tomorrow morning starting at 6 a.m. right here on 103.3 KUMD, Duluth Public Radio. In the meantime, mind how you go. Our forecast for today, hot and muggy again. We've got a chance of some showers and thunderstorms and a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 11 o'clock. About 88 for a high today. Tomorrow, sunny and cooler with highs near 73 degrees.